Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's the end of the world as we know it. The old song by R.E.M., but there are still people singing the chorus to this day, people who are saying that we face a climate crisis, an overpopulation crisis. It's the end of the world, and the only solution that they can propose is that we need to stop having children. They propose antinatalism and say we need to stop having children. There's a whole group of these people called the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement. So they all want to get together and say, hey, we all need to agree to stop having kids. We got to save humanity by getting rid of humanity, as much as that makes sense. So we want to talk about antinatalism and how to respond to it here on the Council of Trent podcast. But before we do that, big thanks to our premium subscribers at TrenthornPodcast.com. You make the podcast possible. You've allowed me to expand to YouTube, where I can publish videos in response to current events, like my recent video on Francis Chan and James White and the Eucharist. Go and check that out at Council of Trent at YouTube. Go to YouTube.com, search Council of Trent. We are growing in subscribers. I hope that you will subscribe there to get that content, as well as my rebuttal series. I'm doing a rebuttal to anti-Catholic videos, starting with Pastor Mike Winger's series on Catholicism. You don't want to miss that. And so if you like supporting that, and if you want access to bonus content, sneak peeks of my upcoming books, articles, videos, the ability to submit questions for future episodes, all that and more for as little as $5 a month at TrentHornPodcast.com. Be sure to go and check it out. Now, on to antinatalism. Now, I've seen antinatalism rear its ugly head out in public. I've seen people make snide comments when they see families, usually traditional Catholic or Mormon families, going around with a lot of children. And in the past, it seemed like a lot for people would be like five or seven, like seven or eight or maybe five or something like that. I know a friend, she was out with her five kids, and a man in a restaurant went up to her and said, "You have too many children." I would have said, "Okay, which one of these should I have aborted?" Now, it just amazes me that people will say Catholics are always imposing their views on other people. They stick their noses in other people's business in bedrooms. So it's like Catholics are imposing their views on other people, yet when a Catholic family just goes out to the Dairy Queen and has their five kids, it's everyone else's business to say things like, "Don't you know how birth control works? What are you doing? Starting a basketball team?" And that just amazes me. It really does amaze me, the double standards we see in society, that people will throw up their hands in abject horror when Catholics will make definitive and objective statements on morality, such as the wrongness of abortion, the disordered nature of homosexuality. Yet, they you can't say that, you're judgmental and you're harsh. But these same people will have no qualms going up to a mom with her five kids out and saying something, or degrading moms out with their kids. I'll tell you what really, steams my pants. That's probably not an expression at all. What really just gets me steamed, I guess, is when my wife goes out and people are mean to her, and she has two kids, as if that is too much for people. And they're always mean to my wife when she's out with the kids and I'm not there. One time there was a checkout lady who was really rude to her at Sprouts. And then I drove down to the Sprouts to find her and confront her. And my wife's like, "Nope, I just wanted to share my problem with you, not have you go half tilt, fly off the handle trying to solve it, doing the typical man thing." And then I got there and realized if I make a giant scene in the Sprouts, all I will do is get arrested and my wife will be more angry and I should just go home and listen to her and do something nice for her. But that always happens. I'm not there. But when I'm there, when the father is there, when the husband is there, the comments seem to dial back. Like, I'm just waiting, like, "Go ahead, say something about my kids. Say something about my cute, adorable children." And you see this also in church. I've heard it said, and it's absolutely true, if the church ain't crying, the church is dying. If you don't hear the sounds of babies making age-appropriate vocalizations in church, your church is dying. I read an article just today, I'll probably make a rapid response video about it, about a Methodist church. I thought it might be fake news or satire, but I think it's legitimately real in Minnesota. A Methodist church that is trying to reset and attract younger people. So what was funny, they said to the older people in the pews, "You need to go to another sister church because we want to just have the younger people here." So, like, I'm not going that far. I'm not saying, like, we need just young people and get rid of our senior members of the church. We should all worship together. I'll try to find the link to that and post it on the description at TrenthornPodcast.com, or I'll do a future video about that. But I cannot handle it when people get all in a tizzy about children making age-appropriate vocalizations. Age-appropriate. Obviously, if a kid is screaming his head off and he's inconsolable, you want to take him out for a little bit till he's fine, then bring him back in. But like some children, it's like they can't even make a peep. And the glances, they're like little dagger eyes, will go over at them. No, I love that kids are there. Frankly, I love when kids make little noises that are uncomfortable at mass because they're at least honest enough to tell somebody. Everybody else is just lying, trying to get through it sometimes. So I'm getting emotional here because I love these little kids. You know, Jesus said, let the children come to me. So I think that we should be able to follow that. And that brings us back to the topic today of antinatalism. If we're going to let the children come to Jesus, we have to let the children be born in the first place and be conceived in the first place. And so we have to overcome this antinatalism, whether it's the attitudes out there that think children are a bad thing or those who are alarmists who are saying that the world cannot support more children. We have to be able to respond to that. And so let's look at then the alarmist environmentalist kind of antinatalism. And you hear this all the time. On Catholic Answers, every now and then I get a call from someone saying that they support abortion because the world is quote unquote overpopulated. And I always ask them, okay, when they say the world's overpopulated, I ask them, how many people should the world have for you to feel comfortable that it's not overpopulated? And they can't give me a number because they haven't really thought about the issue. They just have kind of accepted this sort of mantra that they've heard other people in their echo chamber talking about. Well, the world's overpopulated. Why? Because you see images of places that are crowded on the earth. Yeah, there are places that are crowded, but there are also places that are wide open where there's nobody. There's nothing. We call that flyover country here. You know, when I'm flying back east, I look out my airplane window. I see towns and cities, but a lot of times there's a lot of empty space, at least here in the United States and all over the world. So yeah, there are places that are crowded. There are places in the developing world where people don't have access to basic resources. But we can't help those people by just aborting and contracepting children here in the United States or in other Western European countries. That does absolutely nothing to help people in the developing world who frankly need access to better resources. The thing that would help them is the ability to engage in trade, the ability to own their own businesses so they can flourish and grow. We've seen this in places like Hong Kong or Taiwan. These were little hockety-pockety, poor Asian nations that when they just open themselves up to the free market have become some of the most prosperous economies in the East Asian world. So that's something you can read more about that in my book on socialism, which should be out here in a few weeks. But let's talk about the overpopulation myth. This idea that the world is overpopulated. The fact of the matter is we have more than enough food to feed all of the people on the planet today. The concern about overpopulation goes all the way back to 1798 when an English clergyman, Thomas Malthus, wrote an essay on population. And what he said was that, look, human beings reproduce at an exponential rate. So it's a sharp exponential rate that human beings reproduce. And this was 1798 at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution when birth rates were increasing. Because before the Industrial Revolution, people would have a lot of children, but those children would also tend to die early in age. I think the child mortality rate was something like 50%. Half of all children never made it to the age of five. A large number of people never went on to procreate. But with the advent of the Industrial Revolution, people had access to food, to medicine, to resources in ways that they never had before. And now people were having more children and the birth rates were increasing. And Malthus was saying, well, wait, the birth rates are going up exponentially, but the food production rates are going up arithmetically. So imagine the line is spiking up for population, but it's only going in a kind of a lazy diagonal, you know, an easy diagonal gradual slope of a line for food production. And so what Malthus said was, look, the population will increase, the food production cannot possibly keep up with it, and therefore there's going to be massive famines and people will starve. And this thinking carried on for, it's still with us to this day, even though it has been demonstrably disproven. You go to 1968, almost 170 years after Malthus, 1968, Paul Ehrlich wrote his book, The Population Bomb, in the middle of the 1970s. And we were seeing here, after World War II, there was another boom in population, just like what Malthus saw with the Industrial Revolution. Paul Ehrlich and others in the 1970s were seeing in post-World War II America, Europe, and in Asia and other developing countries, a large growth and population. And so Ehrlich sounded the same alarmist critique in his book, The Population Bomb. This is what he wrote in 1968. The battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death. And that is not what happened, though. That's not what happened because human beings are resourceful. We are ingenious. And having more children is a good thing because human beings have a capital or a value that you can't quantify by just saying, well, they're little munchers and they eat this much resource and that's all they're good for. Human beings have minds. They're made in the image and likeness of God. And many of them can go on to do great and wonderful things if you give them a chance. Some of them grow up to be agricultural scientists and specialists who develop ways for us to increase our food production. I'll give you an example. In Malthus's time, 1 hectare of wheat you could produce 1 ton of wheat per hectare of land, H-E-C-T-A-E-R, a hectare. And you could do in the end of the 18th century, you could maybe get, on average in England, about a ton of wheat out of a hectare of land. You needed a lot of farmland. A lot of farmland was wasted or the crop would spoil. It took a lot of farmland to grow a decent amount of food. But today, with new agricultural technologies, with specially designed seeds that can withstand blight, withstand frost, new harvesting techniques, in England today, you can produce 7 to 8 tons of wheat per hectare of land. And we are doing the same kind of revolution in food production all across the world. So what's happened is we have more than enough food. Fact of the matter is, in the developed world, the biggest crisis facing people is not famine, it is obesity. It is having access to too much processed food that is bad for you. But that was the concern. That was the mindset in the 1970s, and people really argued for abortion and contraception then. And you even saw it in media. Of course, I think I've mentioned some of this on the podcast before, but it's well worth revisiting. You look at the 1973 film Soylent Green, and in Soylent Green, the world is overpopulated. Like 40 million people live in New York City. You have to walk over people to get into your house, and it's so overpopulated. And you have, you know, the Soylent company makes little food pellets for people. And what they say is, oh, well, we've run out of crops, so now we're making food pellets out of plankton in the ocean. There was actually a Planned Parenthood advertisement from the 1970s that said, by the end of the decade, people will be either eating plankton or people, a riff on Soylent Green, support Planned Parenthood, support population control measures. And it justified things like the one-child policy in China. My wife has watched it. One Child Nation on Amazon, and it's gruesome. It is absolutely gruesome. She said, "Do you want to watch it with me?" And I said, "No. I mean, I know about the one child policy, and it's like I have so much darkness in life of what I have to deal with, and you know, combating errors to the faith and moral errors and things like that. Sometimes when I get home, I just need a break, and I want to watch my epic rap battles on." My epic rap battles, pitch meetings, and how it should have ended videos on YouTube before I get back into the grind of things the next day. Maybe you're like that with me, but if you want to watch and you want to learn about it, I highly recommend it. The program started in China to curb population efforts that resulted in forced abortions, forced sterilizations. People were taxed. Their homes were foreclosed on if they had more than one child. Now China's relaxed it to 2 children. Ooh, how generous. But this is the mindset, you know, fueling that and other population measures in the 1970s. So Soylent Green, 1973, it's like, oh, well, we'll use plankton, but there's not enough. And it stars Charlton Heston. And at the end of the movie, he finds out that the Soylent Green pellets are actually made of people. And here is that wonderful scene.
I've seen it happening. They've got to tell people.
Tell them what?
The ocean's dying. Plankton's dying. It's people. Soylent Green is made out of people.
They're making our food out of people. Next thing, they'll be breeding us like cattle for food. You gotta tell them. You gotta tell them.
I promise, Tiger. I promise. I'll tell the exchange.
You tell everybody. Listen to me, Hatcher. You gotta tell them Soylent Green is people! We gotta stop them somehow!
And there you go. I just spoiled Soylent Green, but it's still a hilarious film to watch. What's not hilarious, though, is the alarmism that that has come from this. We saw that Ehrlich and others were wrong. You didn't have mass famines in the 1970s. Food production, resource production has kept pace and population is stabilizing. It's going to continue to grow. It's projected. It'll probably peak at the latter half of the 21st century. And then it's going to stabilize as other developing nations reach higher levels of prosperity. Their birth rates are going to naturally decline as well, as we've seen in other parts of the world. In fact, the biggest thing facing some parts of the world, especially nations like Japan and parts of Europe, is a demographic winter. You do not have population replacement rates. You have less than 2.1 children is what you need to replace a population. So you have countries where you have an aging population that's living. At one point, they were supposed to live only to their 60s or 70s. You have populations that are living to their 80s and 90s, but you don't have enough young workers to take care of them. So the specter of assisted suicide and euthanasia is going to loom over this. And that's so when you have these population control measures, the groups that are targeted are always the most helpless. And that's going to be the unborn, and then those at the very beginning of life, and then those at the end of life, or those are going to be targeted in these quote-unquote overpopulation control measures. So the thing is, though, we have enough resources to take care of people. Now, what some people will say is, well, it's not just resources. We have so many people. We have climate change. You know, people are creating greenhouse gases, and so they are going to cause the earth to warm. And that's going to lead to that will lead to famines. That will lead to environmental catastrophe. We need to reduce the number of people because people leave carbon footprints. David Wallace Wells is the author of a new book, The Uninhabitable Earth. And he wrote in New York Magazine, he said, "I now know there are climate horrors to come, some of which will inevitably be visited on my kids. This is what it means for warming to be an all-encompassing, all-touching threat." Let's see. This is this morning a show on probably on the BBC. It's a British morning talk show. They interviewed two women, Blythe Pepineau and Alice Brown, who shared their stories, and they went on to get kind of viral fame. This was back in March of 2019. Went on viral fame for voluntarily choosing to not have children as a way to try to save the planet, to be a model to other people. And I thought their interview was very interesting. Here's a part of the two women explaining their how they felt about choosing to not have children and how deep down it's a very unsettling thing.
You know, this is the time of life. And even last night when we headed out and we've just passed some gorgeous children on the street, you know, these twins in their buggy, their dad was pushing them and we were waving to them. And that was actually when my heart sort of broke last night.
So what do your individual partners think about this? Because it is fraught with anguish. This is a massive personal decision.
Yeah, I think my partner is really only just coming to terms with the decision. You know, it sounds very finite. I do have hope that we can, if we act, we have to really act on a really deep level across the board.
Could this be a deal breaker in your relationship?
No, I don't think so. Not for me and my partner.
How about you?
No, because the thing is that, you know, the reasons for making this choice are so deep and so severe that once you have yourself, you know, for my partner or my family really understood the crisis that has brought us to this decision, they can almost see it as a no-brainer.
But
this is just so sad. I feel so sad for these women because the decision to not have children is such a negligible effect on the future of our environment. Whatever, quote, to see children as only having carbon footprints and not having the little footprints you put on their birth certificate or the footprint they make in the sand when they walk with you on the beach and you hold them. It's just night and day to me. It's just completely different. That the threat that they're seeing, yes, we should be concerned about the environment. And maybe I'll do a future episode about my thoughts on climate change and things like that. I do believe we should do something to make sure that we take care of the environment. Though I've said it on the podcast before, I believe in practical measures. I think these two women would do far better to have kids and devote their time lobbying for nuclear power. Tell England, start up more nuclear power plants. Get away from fossil fuels. Nuclear is a great way to reduce your carbon footprint. You know, it's a great form of energy that is safe, that is clean to the environment. You know, I've talked about this. Go back to Free For All Friday. I have a whole Free For All Friday on nuclear power you have to listen to. But there's so many other practical things you could do if you care about the environment. This, and I'm not going to besmirch their motivations, these women at least, but I think a lot of other people will choose to do things. And it's really virtue signaling. It's virtue signaling. It doesn't accomplish anything. It's like when Greta Thunberg came to the U.S. on a solar-powered sailboat because she was concerned about climate. I believe, from the news reports that I read, that first, that sailboat had to be constructed out of petroleum products, which, of course, has a massive carbon footprint. Second, two people from overseas had to fly across the ocean to sail the boat back home, back to Sweden. She sailed the boat so she wouldn't fly in an airplane and have a carbon footprint. But the boat itself, people had to fly to go and retrieve the boat and take it home. So virtue signaling. It's just you're doing something to look good, but you're not actually doing any good. Now these women, though, I feel like that they're really anxious and concerned about the environment. And I feel sad for them that they give up having children because of this. Now, when you look at the actual facts and data, there's not as much to be alarmed about. Ronald Bailey is a really good science writer at Reason Magazine, and he did a review of Lawrence Siegel's new book, Fewer, Richer, Greener. And this is what Bailey says about Fewer, Richer, Greener by Lawrence Siegel. Siegel argues convincingly that humanity has spent two centuries rising from our natural state of abject poverty, and that most of the credit for that goes to market institutions and democracy. Parsing current trends, Siegel foresees world population peaking and stabilizing by the end of this century, hence the fewer. He argues that economic growth will bring humanity much greater wealth and more adept technologies, hence the richer. And thanks to increased urbanization and steadily improving material efficiency, Siegel thinks our species will tread more lightly on many natural ecosystems, hence the greener. So when you go and see how economic development has helped people, it's made countries more wealthy. And as countries become wealthier, they actually care more about the environment. Bailey says, economists have identified an inverted U-shaped relationship, the environmental Kuznets curve, in which environmental conditions initially deteriorate as economic growth takes off, then improve when citizens with rising incomes demand better environmental amenities. For example, research has found that rising incomes eventually led to falling air and water pollution and the expansion of forests. Generally speaking, richer is cleaner. So we see this. You go to England in the middle of the 19th century. In Dickens' book, Hard Times, he talks about the fictional town of Coketown, which is based on Manchester. And he says it has a black canal in it and a river that ran purple with ill-smelling dye, vast piles of buildings full of windows with rattling machines. And he goes on to talk about garbage and stench. And you're right. When wealth begins to be accumulated as societies go from an agrarian existence to an industrial one, pollution increases at first, but then as people become richer and more wealthy, they say, hey, I'd like things to be a little bit nicer around here. And they have more resources in order to clean up the environment. We saw the same thing in the United States. After the post-World War II boom in the economy, you saw growth of industrialization and urbanization, and cities were really bad places to be. You had places like New York and LA where you couldn't open your windows sometimes because of the smog. But then once you went past this U-shaped curve, the Kuznets curve, people start to care more about the environment and have disposable income to put towards resources to make things better, to lobby for more environmental protections, and things actually do get better as humanity improves. And I think we can see the same thing with other issues, especially that related to climate change. Bailey says these curves do not peak and turn downward by themselves. They do so with a mixture of private and government actions. In the U.S., levels of six common air pollutants, soot, ozone, lead, carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, and sulfur dioxide, have fallen by an average of 74% since 1970. Even if things did take a turn for the worse, even if we do hit hard spells, we have to remember that children are still valuable in and of themselves. So when people say, oh, it's not worth it to have children, look, children are valuable because they're made in the image and likeness of God. We are valuable because we have immortal souls. Bringing a new human being to existence is valuable because that human being has the potential to spend eternity with God, to have infinite happiness with God. That is why human beings matter. So you're right. If we were just molecular machines, if we did not have an everlasting existence, then maybe we could quibble a little bit about whether it's a great idea to have children. But this life is not the only life that we have. And we also have to remember that our ancestors put up with really terrible conditions and had children. And if they had not done that, we would not be here. Back in March of 2019, Ross Douthat of the New York Times tweeted this: "Just a reminder that every human being alive today exists because their ancestors had children under conditions, pestilence, famine, war, that would beggar the modern imagination." So I would say that don't give in to alarmism, and we need to help people to see that humanity is not the cause of problems we face. It is the solution to them. And we should value human beings because they're made in the image and likeness of God, have intrinsic dignity, and we should not see humans, especially little children, as problems we have to do away with. Human beings, we put a man on the moon, we've wiped out disease. Give humanity a chance. Now, there is another version of the antinatalism argument that's a bit more sophisticated. It's from a philosopher named David Benatar. It's called "Better Never to Have Been: The Harm of Coming into Existence." So Benatar's thesis is basically this: life is bad. It's really bad. If you add up all of the inconveniences we have, and if you look at life, we suffer a lot of pains, some severe, but many minor, and that we overestimate how good our lives really are. So he thinks life in general is not worth living. So you might say, okay, why doesn't Benatar kill himself? Well, he would say, well, life might be worth continuing, but it's not worth starting. He would think of it like a bad movie. If you were in the middle of a bad movie on TV, you might finish watching it, even if it's not a great movie. But if you knew how bad it was, maybe you wouldn't have started the movie in the first place. So what Benatar says is that having children is always a harm to the children that you have. And so you ought not, it's morally wrong to have children. Okay, so what's his argument as a philosopher? Well, one of his arguments is called the symmetry argument. And this is basically how it goes. Pain is bad. Pleasure is good. All right, with you so far. The absence of pain is good. Okay, so you'd think that if there is symmetry, that if pain is bad and the absence of pain is good, and if pleasure is good, that would mean the absence of pleasure is bad. And if the absence of pleasure is a bad thing, then choosing to not have children so that they don't have many rewarding experiences we share in life, that would be bad. Benatar's argument wouldn't work. But Benatar says there is an asymmetry. Yes, pain is bad. Yes, pleasure is good. He says the absence of pain is good, but that the absence of pleasure is just not bad. Okay, so for Benatar, the absence of pleasure is not a bad thing in and of itself that we have to worry about. That if you don't have children and they don't live rewarding lives, that is a situation he would call not bad. The deprivation of pleasure, from Benatar's view, is that it's only bad, the deprivation of pleasure, if there is someone who exists to appreciate that they lost out on the pleasure. And so Benatar's main point is this. Well, this is what he says, quote, "The absence of bad things, such as pain, is good, even if there is nobody to enjoy that good. Whereas the absence of good things, such as pleasure, is bad only if there is somebody who is deprived of these good things." I'm going to keep walking you through this. You got to, and these philosophers get out there. A lot of people, I've met a lot of antinatalists online who subscribe to the symmetry argument. And so what they'll say is, yeah, if a situation in the world where there is not a bad thing happening, that situation is good from their perspective. But a situation where a good thing is not happening, such as a child not being born into the world, they won't say that that's good or bad. They'll just say, well, that's just not bad. So the main point is this, from Benatar's perspective and the philosophical antinatalist perspective: anyone who is born, their life is a mixture of good and bad. But for the situation of anyone who is not born, that circumstance is a mixture of good and not bad. All right, so anyone who's born, life is good and bad. But if someone is not born, that circumstance is a mixture of good and not bad. Instead of good and bad, it's good and not bad. And so that means not being born will always have more good than being born, which is a mixture of good and bad. And so that, my friends, is Benatar's philosophical argument for antinatalism based on the argument from asymmetry. But here's the problem. It's a false symmetry, or it's an incorrect asymmetry. Okay? Non-existence cannot be less bad for a person who does not exist. Moreover, we can't say that the absence of something is good in and of itself. In fact, evil, the classical definition of evil, is a privation of the good. So like when we see a field of grass, just a field of grass wafting in the wind, what is good about that is that the grass is behaving as grass ought to. It's growing, it's green, it's full, it's acting in accordance with its nature. It's not good because, hey, you know what this field of grass does not have? A crying child in it who's suffering from a famine. I mean, that's ludicrous. We don't say that that situation is good because it does not have certain bad things that we can imagine. That's not the case. It's good in virtue of what it is. Something is bad in virtue of what it is lacking or what it's missing. Another philosopher, Elizabeth Harmon, she's an interesting philosopher from Princeton. She has kind of a wacky argument for abortion. I'll have to address that at some point on the podcast. Chris Kazor addresses it in his book, The Ethics of Abortion. Harmon's argument is that a fetus is only a person if it has a valuable future. And so if you choose to abort a fetus, it doesn't have a future, so it's not a person. Yeah, I know. She tried to explain it to James Franco, and he's like, what? Even Franco wasn't going to that in an interview on his YouTube channel. But Harmon does have a decent critique of Benatar's antinatalism, the asymmetry argument. And she raises this point. She says, you know, about his assessment of life and about how life really isn't worth living. She says, Benatar doesn't directly address the thought that some pleasures are of a different kind and thereby have much more value than any pains have disvalue. This does raise the question whether there are higher quality pains. If there are some experiences that have very strong disvalue, then the mere fact that many lives have considerable higher quality pleasures in them does not show that these lives are, all things considered, worth living. I'm not sure whether there are higher quality pains. So Harmon's main point is that Benatar overemphasizes the badness of life by saying, look at all these, for Benatar, anything, you have an itch, you're hungry, you're thirsty, anything that feels bad, those things add up and they're going to be worse than the goods that we suffer. And it's true, we might have more bad feelings, quote unquote, through life, but those bad feelings aren't necessarily bad things because they can contribute to our overall goodness as a person. It was Rabbi Abraham Heschel, he once said, the man who hasn't suffered, what could he possibly know anyways? Imagine how impoverished our lives would be if we did not go through suffering this life. That doesn't mean suffering is necessary for us to be full and complete persons. God has created, angels who have never suffered throughout their existence. For example, children who are born, baptized, and die shortly after baptism might have extremely little suffering and go on to have an entire existence of blessed happiness. Well, my point is that if God makes us, that God, who is omnipotent and all-knowing, can take any kind of evil or suffering in this life and draw a greater good from that. And so if we look at life as just something to say, oh, well, life is only about avoiding pain, that's just a very morally impoverished way of living. Say, I just want to feel good. I don't want to feel bad. Sometimes feeling bad is good for us, that we as human beings are not the sum total. We're not a calculus where you add up all of this is what John Stuart Mill tried to do in the 19th century. He developed utilitarianism and he had a calculus that you could see an action was right or wrong and you could add it up, that if an action caused pain, it made 50 dolars of pain. Dolar is, you know, the Latin word for pain. In Spanish, I think it's like, you know, tango dolor, I have pain. If it has 50 dolars of pain and only 25 unit hedons, you know, hedon is good or pleasure, 25 hedons of happiness, then you ought not do that. I'm sorry, human beings are more than a collection of dolars and hedons. We cannot look at the good as just an aggregate of pain and pleasure. It is better to be a morally good person who suffers greatly than it is to be a morally evil person who benefits greatly and has a lot of pleasure in life. And that's just better because it's who we are. And through that, we find our ultimate happiness and ironically, our ultimate pleasure in God who made us for him. So, well, we covered a lot of ground here. I hope that was helpful for you to help confront antinatalism in all of its views. Stay tuned this week. All goes according to the plan, at least from the time I recorded this, if we're still good on our scheduling. I'll be doing a dialogue, I'll air on Thursday, a dialogue with atheist Tom Jump on whether we should be atheists. Tom is an interesting guy, and so I think we'll have a very interesting dialogue. Stay tuned for that. this Thursday. And be sure to go support us at trendhornpodcast.com. Be sure to leave a review at iTunes or Google Play. That's always helpful for us. Thank you all so much, and I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trendhornpodcast.com.